Welcome to another podcast from the Peter Wall Institute for Advanced Studies at UBC. For more information on our programs, visit pwias.ubc.ca or follow us on Twitter at Wall Institute.
I've been involved with the Peter Wall Institute for several years, initially helping out with the communication strategy, and then more recently as a research associate. And it's a real pleasure to be here to be able to talk about my book, Tell Everyone. What I try to do in this book is not think about social media as shiny toys that we should all use or technology, but really dig into how this is changing things we do every day, from keeping touch with friends, to raising money for charities, to joining causes and campaigning on their behalf, to the way we learn about what's important in the world. There's a lot that we could talk about. I'm going to focus on the idea of how different voices and ideas emerge through social media and how some of those voices can challenge established elites and really give you sort of an insider's view into what happens and how the dynamics of social media in fact privilege sort of more grassroots activist voices and can negate some of the forces of institutional elites. Now this, I'm not going to present a utopian vision here. If you want a utopian vision, then we can go back to the early days of the internet when everybody thought this is going to be wonderful. And in the book, I quote John Perry Barlow, the former Grateful Dead lyricist. And he issued in 1996 this declaration of independence of cyberspace. And you know, John Perry Barlow talked about it at the time as this is a world where, quotes, all may enter without privilege or prejudice, accorded by race, economic power, military force, or station of birth. And you know, he really thought about this as a utopian space where, and again I quote, anyone may express his or her beliefs, no matter how singular, without fear of being coerced into silence or conformity. So John Perry Barlow was kind of half right. Like, everybody can have a voice today. You know, as individuals, as a society, we're sharing more of our experiences, perspectives, and insights with more people in more ways than ever before. You know, if you pause to think of the amount of material that circulates on social media, there's 500 million tweets every day. There's 100 hours of YouTube uploaded there every minute. 3 million likes on Facebook every hour. And of course, Instagram has 60 million photos every day. And these are figures from last year. So this is continuing to grow. So it seems that after 20 years or so after John Perry Barlow's declaration, everybody's talking. Great, we've got this utopian dream. But that's the problem. The problem isn't having a voice. It's actually being heard. And the inconvenient truth here is that basically most of your tweets, most of your photos, most of your likes, most of your shares basically just wither in the perpetual onslaught of information. I'm sorry to say it, nobody sees what you post. It just dies. And one of the things I did in this book, I looked at, it's a very interdisciplinary book because I really looked for this into a lot of computer science work, looking at how ideas circulate through social media, essentially the dynamics of information diffusion. And what these studies show you is that while some ideas carry on and become memes and go viral, most don't. What tends to happen is a bit of information goes from an individual, the immediate social circle, and then quickly disappears into obscurity. Basically, this is why nobody is looking at your tweets, why nobody retweets you. It's just the environment in which we're in. You know, in the 17th century, the English philosopher Thomas Hobbes, he described life as solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. In the 21st century, the life of an idea on social media is similarly solitary, nasty, brutish, and short. There's one study that I talk about in the book from Indiana University. So they said, okay, let's try this out. They created a virtual Twitterverse. They took 120 million retweets from 12.5 million users. And instead of saying, well, let's take one idea and see how it spread, they say, let's replicate what actually happens. All this stuff gets released at the same time, which is a very different environment to the way we tend to study, because we'll study one piece of information and see, oh, how did that circulate? But actually what they said is, let's see, if we put everything together and everything is competing for attention, as it is in real life, what happens? And basically what happens is that most of these things never go anywhere. Sometimes things do catch on, but sometimes they catch on by chance. So when you hear digital marketing people say, I can make your idea go viral, they're not strictly telling the truth. They can't promise that. Basically, sometimes things catch on, not because there's an influential figure, or it's quirky, or it's particularly clever. Sometimes what happens is, in this survival of the fittest, that the personal power of any particular person can be negated by the choices of thousands of others, and something unexpected will suddenly rise to the top. Now, this doesn't mean that, you know, if you have Katy Perry and Dancing Sharks, that's not going to dominate your Facebook feed the next day because it's Katy Perry, it's Super Bowl, and it's got Dancing Sharks. But it's sort of when you try to get something out there, you know, it's very hard to guarantee it's going to catch on. And the problem is about supply and demand. There's just more and more, but our supply of attention is fixed. And social media can only support a limited amount of ideas at any one time. And as new ideas rise, others quickly become extinct. So it's about attention, and how then attention is assigned on social media. What's interesting here, and I look at this through sort of journalist lens, is that as a journalist, you think if you have a really good story, it's bound to be interesting. But actually, not necessarily. And I want to take you back to 2012 and the death of Whitney Houston. So journalists are always obsessed with breaking the news. Seriously, they care about seconds way too much. But here, the first person to break the news of Whitney Houston's death was an American teen called Anya Dior. And she heard it from her aunt. And what she tweeted was, OMGG, my aunt Tiffany, who worked for Whitney Houston, just found Whitney Houston dead in the tub. Such a shame and sad, sad face. Like, yeah, what do you expect an American teen to tweet? So she was, Dior was the first person to break the news. And you would have thought, wow, given Whitney Houston, this would catch on. Basically, Dior's citing a credible source, her aunt. She's got poor grammar and punctuation, which are all indicators of credibility on social media. If somebody writes a perfect headline, they're probably faking. If somebody swears and makes grammatical mistakes, they're probably telling the truth. So this seems authentic, but it just disappeared. Nobody really noticed. And it wasn't until 42 minutes later when the Associated Press sent out a news alert on Twitter that the world learned of the death of Whitney Houston. A company called Social Flow went back to say, well, why didn't this go anywhere? And essentially, her news only spread within the small circle of friends that she was connected to on Twitter, basically 15 people. None of them was well connected or prominent to get this to travel elsewhere, and it just stayed within that little circle. It didn't go anywhere. So Anya Dior had, you know, a topical piece of information, something that would have had currency at the right time for an audience who would want to hear this news. But she didn't have the connections. She didn't have that network to make it go further, and it was just lost. So we could say, yes, she wasn't an influential person. And there are people on social media who are more influential than others. They're easy to identify. But once you get beyond personalities, business leaders, celebrities, etc., it's much harder then to figure out who is actually going to be influential at any particular time. And that's what happened with Anya Dior. Not an influential, but a great piece of news that didn't actually surface anywhere. Partly because there's no way of discovering it at the moment, and there's just so much information. But what's interesting here is that actually the crowd can help elevate certain individuals. So you don't need to be famous to be famous on social media. So again, I want to take you back in time to Tahrir Square in 2011 and talk about an Egyptian woman called Gigi Ibrahim. So she's a graduate of the American University of Cairo. She studied political science, describes herself as a professional revolutionary. On Twitter, her handle is G-squared-86. And during those weeks in Egypt, she became a go-to source about what was happening, documenting what was happening there through tweets, through photos, through videos. She did tweet in Arabic, but then turned to mostly English. And what happened over that sort of January, February, is she then became, in the Western media, the face of the revolution. You know, she even made the cover of a Time magazine at the end of February, as a member of what they described as the generation changing the world. Gigi was like the ideal poster child for the revolution, certainly for the West. She came from one of Egypt's elite families. Born in California, grew up in Egypt, and then back to California and Western educated there. Spoke perfect English, is articulate, often described by male journalists as attractive and young. So suddenly you have for journalists a model eyewitness. She speaks your language, she's articulate, she looks good on camera, and she's readily available. But also, activists like her had a message that we in the West wanted to hear. You know, we wanted to hear the story of people struggling to shake off the yoke of 30 years of Mubarak rule. And she represented what we in the West really wanted to see. You know, liberals like us who aspire to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, this is a very seductive idea that we have these, you know, young people who know about technology and armed with their camera phones and Facebook pages, they can actually spark a revolution. And, you know, of course, individuals like Gigi did play a role, but then there were also thousands of others, older, using other forms of protest, trade unions, a whole long history there that don't get represented through social media. And in particular in the West, you didn't really want to hear the story of the Muslim Brotherhood that effectively had been the opposition for decades in Egypt. We don't want these bearded men who just speak Arabic. We want the young, pretty, American, educated woman who basically is like us. But what's interesting with Gigi is that, yes, she was fettered in the media, but she also emerged as a key actor on social media before the Western media noticed that she existed. So even before she became this face of the revolution, she was being noticed by Egyptians taking part in these protests. You know, she had started documenting what was going on in the month of January leading up to the National Day of Protest on the 25th. And on the day itself, what she was doing is she was basically not just expressing her hopes for change, but also documenting what was actually happening on the streets. She was almost providing a blow-by-blow account of how to get to Tahrir Square, where the police were, where people were being searched, what roads were blocked, what alternative routes could be taken. All this sort of real-time information that was of great value to people trying to get together. What that meant is others trying to figure out how do I get to Tahrir Square and avoid getting arrested or beaten up, started retweeting her, following her, because she was providing real, valuable, just-in-time information. You know, she had topical information for an audience that needed it. It was very much stuff, information they needed. So she starts getting picked up by other people taking part in the protest through social media. Then some other prominent Egyptian activists also taking part in the protest notice that, oh, this person keeps getting retweeted a lot. So what you then have is respected dissidents who then notice her, because they notice she's been retweeted, and retweet her again. So she starts getting a higher profile. And this happened both in Egypt and also outside Egypt. So what this meant is that by the end of the day, she became this very prominent voice on social media through the actions of the crowd there who brought us to the attention of other people who were more influential, and so it spread. So Gigi is what sociologist Zeynep Tofiki describes as a networked micro-celebrity activist. So these are politically motivated individuals. They turn to social media for their causes. They mix journalism and advocacy together. And they often use language that's quite emotional. They use affect to get people engaged with the story. What tends to happen then is they get attention on Twitter. They become these micro-celebrities on the network, and slowly get noticed by then the media outside of social media, and they become the face of the revolution. So you have these two forces at work. One, the crowd itself is choosing who do I listen to, elevating certain voices, and then the media reinforcing those choices by identifying them and giving them an added bonus, which then of course gives them greater celebrity on social media, and the rich keep on getting richer. But it sort of highlights the dynamics of what happens through these networks in terms of how authority and power is distributed and can result in unexpected voices and actors rising to the top. It's interesting, when I was following the events in Tahrir, it had sort of personal resonance for me because I was based in Egypt for a couple of years. And you know, watching what was happening there made me think back to one of the times when I covered a protest by lawyers. A lawyer had been killed in police custody, suspicious circumstances. So had lawyers in their black gowns trying to organize a protest. Of course, protests were illegal at the time. So what happened? Lots of police. They're trying to dispel the lawyers before they can get going. And they fired tear gas. And they fired more tear gas. And more tear gas. And at one point, I remember being there and thinking, my nose is tingling. I think that's tear gas. They had fired so much tear gas, it was basically wafting back towards the police. And the police didn't have gas masks because they didn't expect to be tear gassed. So suddenly all these police start panicking, running towards the journalists who are basically at a safe distance. And I have this fragmented memory of sort of running, one of my colleagues who now works as AP, stumbling, we stopped to pick her up, trying not to breathe because breathing just burns your throat. Tear gas is one of these things where I don't recommend it, by the way, but you want to breathe because you feel you can't breathe, but you can't breathe because it'll just sear your throat. And you know, some people, Egyptians, you know, sort of crowding to doorways, Egyptians opening the doors, letting us in, giving us wet towels to try to mitigate the effects of the tear gas. And watching Tahrir struck me, oh, there's no tweets about it, there's no video on YouTube, there's no Facebook posts. It wasn't reported in the Egyptian media. It's like this little footnote that, you know, I got a little mention in the BBC, but no record of it. And yet here am I, not quite 20 years later, seeing this, and you're seeing an event that, yes, it's been reported by the TV networks and it's on 24/7, but it's also been tweeted, Facebooked, captured on YouTube by the people taking part in these protests. But I think more significant than the fact that we have these eyewitnesses, these people who then tell their own story, is what happened to Gigi. How activists can then turn to social media to tell their own narrative of events. And individuals can rise to prominence that have a very different narrative to what we may see through mainstream media. And this is one thing that we see a lot with, we've seen with recent social movements like Occupy, where individuals, these sort of micro-celebrity activists, seek to appropriate social media as one of the main tools to articulate their own story and often contest what becomes a dismissive narrative in the mainstream media. For journalists, one of the things that I'm looking at with this is, well, journalists, it's hard to cover movements like Occupy or Idle No More, because these are not, they don't have an association behind them necessarily, they don't have structures, they don't have traditional leaders, they don't often have specific, concise demands. You know, journalists want to know, what do you want? Who's your leader? Take me to your leader and give me your demands. And these movements have this sort of meta-narrative where they have common causes, but maybe not specific things they want to be done today. And in the book, one of the things I talk about is the research I've been doing with my colleague Candice Collison at the School of Journalism, looking into how this happened and evolved through Idle No More and the protests here. Again, with similar to the Arab Spring and to Occupy, with Idle No More, the protesters there turned to social media to mobilize supporters, amplify the message, and using very much Twitter as their platform, using the Idle No More hashtag. What we found in our research is looking in terms of what voices rose to prominence within social media and how did that compare to who was actually being quoted in the mainstream media as representative of the movement or commenting on the movement. And this is one of the things you find in terms of how social networks assign authority compared to the way we journalists work. So if you take a look at the Globe and Mail or CBC Any Day, you know, take a look, who gets quoted? Well, you know, you have government ministers, MPs, business leaders, experts, essentially people in positions of authority who have legitimacy. It's kind of how the news works. As journalists, you say, okay, I want to quote, you know, I'm going to quote the president of UBC, not a student, because the president has more authority. That's just how we work. We turn to positions in power, and we assume that because they are in positions of power, they have legitimacy and credibility. And then when it comes to reporting on protests especially, what tends to happen there with the media is if we do quote those alternative activist voices, we tend to marginalize them. We tend to present them as deviant, which is what happened to the Occupy movement. But when you look at what's happening on social media, you get a very different picture in terms of who those engaged with the cause are listening to. Because on social media, that authority can be assigned by the crowd. They can make decisions saying, this is somebody worth listening to, and give prominence to that voice. You know, the act of sharing is a way of assigning influence to particular messages and particular people. And then when you multiply this by thousands and thousands of retweets, you can then measure who is getting attention. In the research, we looked at basically who were people engaged with Idle No More through social media listening to. Who did they retweet? Who did they say, you have something important to say that I think is valuable enough for me to put my weight behind it and retweet it to the people I know? And what we found is that at the height of the protest in December 2011 and January 2012, the most retweeted messages came from activists and from Indigenous celebrities. So they're still celebrities, but the Indigenous celebrities that tend not to get represented in the sort of white mainstream media. So we have activists, Indigenous celebrities, but also what we found were a handful of individuals. You know, a handful of these networked micro-celebrity activists who basically you would never go to as a source, but they were being chosen by people who cared about this. And there was one very unlikely one that struck me was a woman called Patricia Stein, Native American from North Dakota. And at the time, she went under the Twitter handle of Pygmy Sue, and later changed it to Sue Sweet and Sour. So we thought, this is odd. Why do we have Pygmy Sue as one of the most influential voices in Idle No More? So I did some research. So at the time, in December 2011, she was in Egypt. She'd been in Egypt since 2010. She was teaching English and art to young children. And when she heard of what was happening in Canada, as a Native American, she identified with the movement and said, I'm going to hold my own protest outside the Canadian embassy in Cairo. So on December the 21st, she went with a friend outside the embassy. They had two signs. One of them had the name of Idle No More over the picture of an Indigenous dancer. Two people outside the Canadian embassy, nobody cares. But APTN, the Aboriginal People's Television Network, picked this up, that this Native American had decided to go to the Canadian embassy and hold up a sign. And that gave her a boost. People came to notice what she was tweeting about the movement. And then, of course, the Idle No More Facebook page picked up on her micro-celebrity, posted it there. So they gave her a boost to gain people within the movement. And by the end of January 2012, in our research, she was the 11th most retweeted person, you know, just outside the top 10, which is quite startling considering, really, she's not an activist, specifically an Indigenous activist, she's not Canadian, she wasn't even in Canada, but yet the crowd decided this was somebody worth listening to and paying attention to. So this is where the discrepancy comes in. So on Twitter, on social media, where a lot of these movements work, sort of think of Twitter as the switching mechanism through which they communicate, mobilize, articulate their own story. You have people engaged who care about this. Who are they paying attention to? Activists, Indigenous celebrities, and these micro-celebrity activists. So I'll ask you a question. Who do you think the national press was quoting during this same period? I'll give you a clue. They did not quote Patricia Stein. You know, what did they quote? Well, they quoted politicians. They quoted institutions. They quoted elected Indigenous leaders. They quoted experts and researchers. Only a fraction were people taking part in the protests, and then often as eyewitnesses of the protest rather than presenting a narrative. So you have this real dichotomy where there's this movement of people who really care about this, saying these are the people we think are speaking for us, are articulating our message in powerful ways, are telling our stories, are telling our narrative. And what is the mainstream media doing? Basically saying, we'll just talk to the people we always talk to, even though actually they're not really representative of what is actually happening there and the people engaged with that movement. And what you see here is that the crowd is assigning influence, but also elevating voices that give you a different narrative, a different take on what's going on. And I think this is what's really interesting with social media, is that how it allows different set of voices to be seen and heard outside established channels, outside the institutional preferences of journalists. And it takes that communicative power away from the institutional elites, that actors who have structural power, like politicians, business leaders, experts, like myself, you know, that we don't necessarily keep that structural power when we move onto this network, because the people who really care about this are saying, actually, Alf, we don't care what you say. I know you were quoted in the Globe, but we don't care. We actually think Patricia has something important to say. They're reassigning influence and power. So what you then have is that who gets to speak on these issues and who is listened to is up for grabs. It's much more contested. And the nature of the dynamics of the network mean that some of the power you take from outside the network can be negated by the dynamics and interactions on that network. What, particularly with Idle No More, the sort of the crowdsourced elite that emerged, what they were doing was both affirming the legitimacy of the movement, saying, look, we are important, we matter, this is what we are about, but also contesting the media narrative, which tends to be dismissive. Those natives, they should stop complaining, just let the white man decide what's good for them, which is often the narrative we get in the mainstream media. And essentially using social media, saying, look, these are the people who we should be listening to, the ones who are telling our story, who are reflecting our ambitions, who are articulating our hopes, not the people who you're being quoted in the Globe or in CBC. So what you see then in this contested space of social media is that there's a struggle for attention, for power, for influence. And all these factors are assigned and reassigned. They're temporal, they're relational. They change. They change by topic, they change by network. You have groups of people who don't know each other who come together on an ad hoc basis and decide, this is who I want to listen to. And essentially what then that means is how we see an event, what we think is important, what makes the news, or how that news is framed, is fundamentally different. Now, there's an awful lot more I could talk about, but I'll end it here so we can have some time for questions. Thank you.